Hey y'all, Dayton here. Between the recording and release of this episode of Marathon Mixtapes, I lost my father-in-law unexpectedly. With his passing, my perspective on loss has changed. I talk at length about my former impression of loss in this episode, making these upcoming thoughts sort of artifacts of my innocence and/or ignorance. The fact that I have now undergone such a transformation is a testament to my father-in-law's impact on me, and the void that he now leaves behind. I hope to talk about him and our relationship in a future episode of Marathon Mixtapes, but for now, I just wanted you to know that this man treated me like a son and changed my life for the better. Thank you all for listening. Everyone's got those songs that make them go, "Oh man, I felt that." Songs that resonate with their own individual circumstances and bring them together with others through shared connection. But the same song is guaranteed to speak to different people in vastly different ways. So join Jordan and I, once childhood neighbors in Marathon City, Wisconsin, as we talk through the songs that have struck a chord with us. We'll discuss the similar messages we've heard upon our listens, the lessons we've learned through our own interpretations, and the deeper topics we're navigating as our unique journeys continue beyond our hometown. Welcome to Marathon Mixtapes. Jordan, what song are we talking about this week?
So for the penultimate song that I get to pick, I've decided to pick a song titled Ite by Yoroshika. They are a Japanese band. I think you and I both know that it was only a matter of time before I picked a song that was not in English.
Right.
So before we jump into the meat of the song, I actually wanted to ask you, how was it for you just listening to the song for the first time? I know growing up for me, I listened to a lot of different music, Chinese, Japanese, and even to this day, I listen to a lot of European music in like Italian and Spanish. So I'm kind of used to listening to foreign music, but I don't know if that's necessarily true for you. So I'm curious how your process was listening to this. Have you heard a lot of foreign music up to this point?
Yeah. So great question. And the funny thing is, I think if there's any other language of music that I listen to most in comparison to English, it's probably Japanese music. And it's partially because of some of the songs that you've shown me in the past. I know you and I, as we rode together to high school, you were my ride for a year or two there. As we rode to high school together, you would show me a couple different bands, and one that really stuck with me was Aqua Times or Aqua Time Z.
I've seen
their name stylized in a couple different ways, and I never actually figured out what was correct. But their song Ushin no Chiri is one that I return to, I would say, frequently. So that's one song, but to broaden it a little bit as well, I have a good friend who's really into the band Trico, who is a Japanese math rock band, lots of like jazz influences, kind of punky at times too. And I've discovered sort of a few bands adjacent to them as well. So coming into this song, I had some background in kind of what Japanese rock music kind of broadly could sound like. So it wasn't a complete new territory for me, but rest assured it was something I really, really enjoyed. And as we dig into the meat of this song and the meat of foreign language music or non-English music in general, I'd be really curious to hear about some of the other nationalities and languages that you've experimented with a little bit with through your musical tastes. So yeah, this was a great experience. I really, really adored the song. There's a lot to love about it. There's just the instrumentation itself is totally up my alley. I love post-punk bands like Bloc Party, a little bit of Franz Ferdinand. So this song definitely has a little bit of that characteristic to it, where it's got like the really jaunty, kind of angular guitar riffs. I have had the main guitar lick of this song stuck in my head all week, and I'm totally content with it. It's addictive, I would dare say. And there's also a couple little small touches in the song instrumentally that really surprised me too, like wind chimes. I just have in my notes wind chimes with 3 question marks after it. In our intro, we always talk about striking a chord with us, and that the song has definitely done that.
And unless, I guess, you're hiding a secret from me, I don't believe you are fluent in Japanese. So I'm also curious how you go about listening to this song specifically at, like, in preparation to talk about for this episode. I know you had asked me before this recording that you wanted some help with lyrics and stuff, and so I gave you some translations that I found on the web. But I still am very curious how, when you sit down to listen to this song, do you have, like, the lyrics kind of up first? Do you listen to it just kind of blind?
Yeah.
As a first pass, and then kind of go back and read the lyrics or follow along as you listen to it again?
Yeah, so more the latter. I listened to the song a few times without knowing what the lyrics were. And I, especially in preparation for this episode, I really wanted to focus on what does the vocal performance sound like to me when I'm pretty much completely in the dark on meaning. You had given me a couple hints as to what the song was about to you, at least. But I really went in just thinking about, okay, how is this vocalist saying the words that they're saying? And I found a lot of joy in that, for sure. There's some apprehensive and kind of even playful vibes to the way that the verses are performed and sang. A lot more powerful and yearning when it comes to the choruses. And then once I did start digging into the lyrics, I definitely found more and more appreciation for it. One really clear-cut example of that for me with this song was the repetition of the word moto, which I believe means simply more. You can correct me on that.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. It means, yeah, more.
So I really appreciated how this was performed in the song, especially within the larger context of some of the meaning that I gleaned from it. The singer performs it in such a way where it's quite clear. Like, once I saw it on paper and heard it, I'm like, oh, that was like the first connection between, like, the phonetic spelling and the lyrics that I was hearing that I made. I'm like, oh, moto, I remember hearing that. And the character, the vocalist, is talking about saying things more and more clearly, and they repeat moto, like, very distinctly, like almost like they're practicing it. And once I figured that out and put that together, I was like, oh, okay, this song is very special. And even from a non-Japanese speaker, I can start to piece together some of the details between the English translation, the way it's performed. It's been a lot of fun digging into a song this way, because even though I do have some experience listening to foreign language music, like I said, primarily Japanese rock music, I haven't gone about it in this way, and it was a lot of fun comparing translations and finding little details that resonated with me and brought that extra level of meaning.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it goes to show you, or at least maybe I might be, you know, presuming a little bit to speak on your behalf, but I think going into a song, listening to a song where you don't necessarily understand the language, tend to focus on every aspect more, kind of like how when people say, like, when you're blind, it heightens your other senses. And for this song, if you don't necessarily understand the words or the lyrics, you listen to the tonality of the singer, like how they're singing the words, you listen to the instrumentals more, and it kind of highlights, at least for me, because, like, I do speak Japanese, and I say that not with a full asterisk, but with, like, a half asterisk.
With an upper inflection at the very least. Japanese?
An upper inflection at the very least, because I wouldn't say I'm super fluent, because there's still, like, a lot of areas and topics that I would not be able to speak as confidently as English. But I know a fair bit, and in music, listening comprehension is a lot harder because it's not a normal cadence in words. You have to fit it to melodies and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I notice more like the intricacies of just like communication between people, right? Like when you have a conversation with somebody, when you're on the, at least for me, when I'm like having a phone call with someone, it's a lot harder to understand, or it's a lot easier to misconstrue meaning of what the other person is compared to if I'm like having a face-to-face conversation where I can have like facial cues, body language, and other things that you don't really think about when you're communicating with another person, but they're kind of all built in a single package that you might not think about or take for granted,
right?
Until they're gone. And yeah, I think that's one reason why I like listening to foreign music, just because it makes me pay attention a little more, as opposed to English songs. Although, like, I think it, there's exceptions to the rule, but I think with like foreign language songs, I tend to focus more on, like you said, how the singer is singing the lyrics, because there's feeling baked into that that you don't get from like just reading the lyrics on a page. It's sure. Not until you actually listen to it being sung out that like, oh, you can get certain emotions conveyed through the, you know, through voicing the words in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And this song specifically, Ite, is a good example of how you can really change the feeling. I also did a little digging into kind of like the background of the song and found articles talking about how like the singer and the artist kind of wanted to write another like upbeat song, but with like melancholic lyrics. Again, there's that like dichotomy that I think we saw on a previous episode when we talked about Numb Little Bug, about kind of that contrast between like sad lyrics, like in sad emotional singing, versus like an upbeat high tempo song that makes you, I guess, for lack of a more complicated nuanced term, just makes you kind of like think and listen with a little more intent.
It invites that interpretation right away. And I think what really helped me too with this song is like just the instrumentation is so bold. It's not just a contrast between like happy and sad. There's like a real intensity to the way that this song is performed, but it's also just a really solid rock song, right? I think especially the guitar solo really stuck out to me. I miss guitar solos like this, man. Like this is just throw up the horns kind of thing, right? You just, I imagined, well, to give a little bit of background, I loved the Guitar Hero games when they were big in the late 2000s. Like I was addicted to them and I got pretty good, you know? And this is one of those songs where once that solo came up, I like imagine like, oh, what would this song look like? Like it looked like in the game, like this solo would be so much fun to play, or like this main lick would be so much fun to play. So this song, because of that contrast, and because of just the bare intensity of like the instrumental end being so strongly, like just laying it all out there, it really grabs your attention. And as I dug into the lyrics, it obviously just made the whole tapestry that they were weaving that much more interesting, because sometimes I would listen through it and I would be like, you know, fumbling around with my fingers thinking about like, oh man, how would they fret this out in the game? And then I would listen to it other times and be like, huh, what will my last day look like? You know, I really appreciated the song for that.
Oh, yeah.
It provides vastly different experiences at once, you know.
For sure, for sure. And I think that's a good transition. Like, we can dive into the lyrics a little bit more now about talking about our last days. So, like, this song, I think, as a whole, I think you'd agree, it's a song kind of about words not spoken and kind of like mm-hmm. the realization when it's, like, too late. So the song is titled Ite, which translates to say it. And that's one way you could translate it. And I think that's kind of the intended meaning, at least in the beginning of the song. Ite means to say, or to say it. And all the lyrics are kind of this are kind of about the singer by themselves, kind of like talking to themselves, talking to the air, and reminiscing about somebody else, someone important to them, and kind of thinking back on all the things that this person wished they would have said. And then as you kind of progress through the song, they sing about, you know, what they would do on the last day of their lives and what it meant to have the person that they're thinking about, you know, having met them, like the impact on their lives. And you kind of get the sense as the song progresses from simple regrets, like, oh man, I should have said that. And then toward the end of the song, you realize, oh, they're realizing they should have said something, or they should have, they had a lot of things they wanted to say, but they can't anymore because the person, this important person to the singer, has unfortunately passed away. And I think it right. like really makes the singer think about like their own mortality and their own like kind of life story and kind of what they would do at the end. And there's a great pun in this song that I know I tried to highlight it very strongly when I was like trying to find you lyrics. So like I said, ite means to say it. And I guess, yeah, ite means to say it, but it could mean a lot of other things. It's one of those like very simple words that have a lot of different definitions, kind of like the English word set, S-E-T, like three letters.
Oh, okay.
And it has like, if you look in the dictionary, like 50 meanings. Where like you can conjugate it and then it means like a lot of different things. So ite is actually like a conjugated form of, actually could be a number of things. Like the, could be the base word iu or iku, but iu, and in this case, the ite from iu means to say or to speak.
Okay.
But ite could also be a conjugation of the verb iku, which means to go. And even okay. to go, right? That can be taken a lot of different ways. Like literally, like I'm leaving this place, like, and I'm going to the supermarket. I'm going to the supermarket. But even in English, we say, you know, people have went when they pass away.
Mm-hmm.
And they use that in the song here too. And the first verse of this song is a lyrics where the singer is just like, oh, you know what? You know, I've noticed that thing you've said, as they're thinking back on kind of past conversations with this important person. And then towards the end of the song, probably like in the middle of the second half, they start a verse almost exactly like the beginning of the song. But in this context, instead of meaning, I know I've been thinking about what you said, the same sentence in this different context means, oh, I know that you're already gone or you've already passed.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of a very brilliant use of wordplay in the song that it really, when I listened to it the first couple times, that was like when the switch flipped for me, that was like, oh, and I kind of understood the, I guess, gravitas of like the lyrics in the song where right. it changed from, you know, like I was thinking about you, what you said, to, oh, I know that you've passed on. And then to me, that was when it opened like this new window of meaning to the song about this person kind of going through a grieving process. And I was curious, like, what you thought about this.
Yeah, no, I'm super glad you pointed this out to me, because it is a nice framing device for the whole, for if we're interpreting the song, but then also finding it, meaning in it myself. And maybe this is a little bit of a leap linguistically, but something that I found very powerful about this pun, this double meaning, thinking about this characters, they're constantly thinking about saying things more intentionally, or saying things more clearly. And there's even a moment in the song, well, I'm getting ahead of myself here, so you could say it from that, you could think about it from that interpretation, right? Saying things more clearly and saying things when you mean them and when you have something to say, right? And then on the flip side, okay, let's think about that from the living standpoint. So I want to live more intentionally. I want to live with more meaning. I want to live with that sort of extra vitality, right? I don't know if that, maybe that's a little bit of a leap linguistically, but I certainly found that meaning in the song where it's like, this person has passed on, so now I'm thinking about living life with a bit more purpose based on what they've told me and the things that they've shared and the memories I have of them and the way I've dwelled on them, the way I've found meaning in them. And there's even a moment in the song where they talk about, oh, I lived recklessly, negatively, and that didn't really get me anywhere. So this alternative is saying what you mean, living with meaning. So that's a really big lesson I got out of the song. I know it's something that I'm trying to do more and more in life, is just focus on saying what I mean. You know, it sounds so... I say this almost every episode where I have these little personal revelations where it's like, oh, it sounds silly to say it out loud, but it really is true, where it's like so much of our language is just small talk, just responding with things that, you know, oh, this person said this, I say this, this is the joke, this is my line, right? But speaking with more meaning and focusing on the words that you say and really giving somebody something when you say something, right?
Yeah.
I think living can be interpreted very much in the same way, where you're like, oh, I'm just not going to be arbitrary in the way I carry my life. I'm going to give people myself. I'm going to give people meaning. And that in turn sort of fulfills my own sense of meaning. So when you revealed that linguistic sort of functionality to me with the conjugation of that verb, it gave me kind of this whole orbital, like, oh, okay, everything's kind of spinning around this pun and it works. And I'm finding so many things to walk away with and reinforce and put into practice more in my own life.
That's something that I didn't really think of too much until you brought it up, but in the chorus, they have that repetition of molto, which again, yeah, it means more, and the singer repeats it quite a bit, like in every chorus, to really hammer home, like, oh, I should have said more. But then at the very end, it switches from molto to canto, which means not more, but it means, when used with a verb, it means like do it properly. And I think that speaks to what you're saying, kind of like more intentionally and more as yourself. So I definitely didn't see that before, but like see that now. And I think it's like another cool way the song uses its lyrics to really like drive home their message, not just through the lyrics, but also kind of the delivery of the lyrics and like the repetition of certain lyrics and juxtaposed with other lyrics to kind of create that emphasis.
Right.
And on another side of that, on like a more literal meaning of saying things more, I think one of the big reasons why I chose this song to talk about today and why it has such a big impact on me and like why I think this song will kind of stick with me for a long time, if not until the very end, is that in a literal sense, like I feel like I relate a lot to the feeling of wishing I had said more, whether that be in like, you know, personal relationships or familial relationships, but just kind of saying more when you have the chance. I think I'm like a sucker for family dramas, whether it be like sappy soap operas or comedies or, you know, the ones that really pull on your heartstrings. And especially more so if in the story there's like a death and then of like a parental figure or like a mentor figure. And then there's the grieving process by the character being like, oh, now that they're gone, this is like a very definitive point where I know now like I can't talk to them anymore. And then you get the rush of emotions of all the regrets that are now like finalized,
right,
in stone, where it's like, oh, I can't. You know, all the things I wanted to say and just didn't get around to. Well, it's too late now and the regret's there. This song, on a surface level, I think that's, I would say, the main message. You know, the singer is singing about a very important person to them, and you realize partway into the song that this important person has passed on, and the singer is kind of just singing out loud to themselves, kind of grieving and regretting all the things that they wish they could say. which they could say to this important person. And I really love the, I guess, yeah, it's like the bridge where the singer just goes and lists off a lot of like little things that they could have said. Like, they start the bridge with like, oh, I should have properly said it out loud to you more. Make notes so you won't forget. Or, you know, let's meet at the train platform at tomorrow at 10 a.m. Like little minute things that might not have a lot of detail. But when you think about it, just it's kind of like the little things that you could have said would have like such a deeper impact than you would think. And I think the singer, at least in these lyrics, is realizing that.
Yeah, it's like a small celebration of just communication in general, right? Like just having the opportunity to talk to somebody. I mean, like these things are innocuous to think about telling them to remember something by writing it down or telling them that like, oh, yep, this is when we're going to meet. We're going to meet at this area. I don't think I've ever run into a song that kind of celebrates. I've run into songs that celebrate like smaller details like that, but just like a song that uplifts the opportunity to communicate with somebody and treasures that, I think that's a really uniquely powerful mm-hmm. element of this song.
Yeah, and even in the beginning of the song, in the lyrics, you realize the singer really is like realizing how, maybe not important, but how impactful or like how great of a gift just, you know, talking to someone can be.
Yeah,
there's lyrics later in the song where they're just kind of contemplating like, you know, how should I tell you that the sky is blue today? Or, you know, I don't know what I can say to make you understand that the clouds are high in the night sky. Like little observations like this for me, like, again, highlight, you know, thinking of someone very important to you that has like passed away and realizing now like you no longer have the ability to just say simple things like this, and then realizing, you know, how cool or like how meaningful it is even just to talk about like the mundane things, like how, oh, the sky is blue today, or oh, those clouds are high in the sky, aren't they? Like those little things that once someone is gone, like it just gets completely wiped out, and then you realize the importance of even the small things you have with a person.
Yeah, and I think there's a strong sense too that this character or singer found a lot of like safety and like and fulfillment in when they did have the opportunity to express that. You know, maybe it was something that was rewarded. You know, I think about that in my own marriage where I was kind of knocking down small talk earlier, because I think there is a version of that that is transactional, right? Think about interacting with the coworkers that you might not have a connection with or something. You know, you're just trying to get through the conversation. But there are small talks that do imbue a lot of meaning into the world and the way that you're experiencing it. You know, like, I just think about, yeah, when I'm driving in the car with my wife and, you know, the air does feel good, I say it, you know, because it's something I'm feeling in that moment. And I feel incredibly mm-hmm. blessed that that's something that Kate responds to and appreciates, you know, just like those small moments of joy to be able to have a relationship where you can share that with somebody and it's recognized, treasured even. I think that's something that this character, this singer had with this person that they're speaking about who's passed on. And in that framework, I'm like, yeah, there are a couple people in my life where I really can kind of just, you know, within reason, say what's on my mind and say what I'm feeling. And they're like, yeah, dude, that's great. Like, I think there's something really special about that, having that kind of relationship where there's that sense of safety, that sense of vulnerability, that sense of appreciation for recognizing the smaller things and not like blowing off or being concerned about like, oh, that's just a tiny thing. That's just Dayton being quirky, or that's just Jordan overthinking something. You know, it's like, no, people are seeing what we're seeing and feeling what we're feeling with us. I think there's something, there's an inherent empathy that's happening with this relationship that this character is now unfortunately lost. And they're looking for another way to find that. They're bummed that they don't have... Bummed is such a... that's such a reductive word in this. They're sad. They're mourning the fact that they don't necessarily have this outlet anymore. And I again, the song is going like a layer deeper in some of these themes that I've seen before, and kind of cracking open a whole new egg to kind of dissect, if I can use that kind of metaphor. You know, there's an extra layer to all of these somewhat familiar themes that they're really tapping into with the way they're playing with language and some of these individual lines.
It actually reminds me of a story, a friend of mine, I remember we were talking, it was a former lab mate of mine, and she told me that like she has such a close connection with her mother that I think like they have texts or, no, it's not text. It was, I remember literally, they have phone calls like every day, if not every, or every week, if not every day. And I was like, oh, what do you guys talk about? And then I think sometimes she's like, oh, I don't know. Sometimes she'll call or I'll call and one of us will be like, oh, how's it going? Are you doing anything like special lately? And then I'll be like, oh, not really. On paper, like just the most like mundane conversation you could think of. Just like, oh, well, how are you? What's up? Not much, you. And at first, I think when I heard that, I was like, that sounds awful. Or like, I just like couldn't understand like,
sure,
what, why? You know, now as I'm older and like thinking back on the story, I think part of me was probably a little like jealous or envious because like it was, I think, a very pure form of connectedness to another person, right?
Yeah.
Like, you have such a strong connection where like you just call each other to talk about nothing for, and then you talk about nothing for like hours. It was something that I think me at the time, the way I was living my life, I feel like I was striving to find meaning in everything I did, everything I said, to try to do and say things with, in the context of being efficient with my energy.
Okay.
But now, like listening to the song more and more, just kind of slowing down a little bit and just enjoying the time I have with the people that I like love around me. And again, I think this song resonates with me or like has such a strong impact on me just because it reminds me of like where I'm at in life. And I think I'm very much like the singer where I have a lot of introspective thoughts on a normal day. And I think that I need to be more vocal and reach out more because up until, you know, several years ago and even now to a certain extent, I've always been kind of like a reserved, quiet person. And even my family would like joke that, why is Jordan being so quiet or being so reserved? What is he hiding? And then my brother being like, oh, that's just him. Or my mom would be like, oh, that's just him. And like hearing that, I'm like, yeah, I guess so. And I don't want to be that because the last thing I want is for like my close family and friends to think that I'm reserved and shut in and hiding something, or not necessarily hiding something, but just I guess from an outside perspective, it's been illuminating to hear that so that I can be more aware of trying to be more open and to just say little small things on my mind that might not necessarily have any deeper meaning than, oh, that's a pretty cloud up there. And so the song has so many layers of meaning about like regrets and connections with other people that are important to you that I think just have checked so many boxes for me personally. But like, what about you when you listen to the song about the singer and this important person that has passed away? Do you have anybody in your life that you can think of that kind of puts you in a very similar situation as the character in the song?
Yeah, and I think something that it's really brought to the forefront for me is, well, number one, I'm quite fortunate in that I haven't I haven't had any like major, super close loss to me. Both of my grandfathers have passed, and especially one of them I was fairly close to, but I wouldn't say I really had, you know, and I think a lot of people, you know, and I hope by saying this, a lot of people can sort of admit to it for themselves too. It's just like, I didn't really necessarily have a relationship with my grandfathers, independence of sort of like the larger family structure. You know, it was always about like interacting with them at a party or interacting with them within the context of also my grandmother, or also my father, or also my mother, whoever, you know, whichever family side of the family it was, kind of thing. At the same time, you know, it's like, man, I wish I would have asked them a few more questions. Maybe that individual connection would have been formed a little bit more. But what the song really did for me is it kind of gave me a sense of urgency about the people who I still do have around. Both of my grandmothers are still around. I've talked about them before on the podcast, and I'm trying to be more intentional with them, you know, say things more clearly, right? And to ask them more questions. I think about like, hey, maybe there was a missed opportunity with my grandfathers. Maybe there's something I can forge here with my grandmothers, or even with my parents. You and I are getting to the age where our parents are getting up there. My mother's already retired, and my dad's going to retire in less than a year here. So they're really going to be entering the sort of sunset of life, not to be morbid, but they're done with their working years virtually, and they're going to be trying to really fill their time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to think about how I can be more intentional with them and have more meaningful conversations. And with my parents especially, that's taken the form of just being more honest with them throughout every aspect of my life, you know? And for me, a big part of that is being honest with them about my faith. I've mentioned before here on the podcast that I'm still a Christian, but I don't prescribe to any sort of specific denomination or really even wing of Christianity right now. As much as it would pain my old pastors to hear, I'm kind of a cafeteria Christian right now, you know, just sort of picking and choosing what works for me and kind of throwing away the ugly things that limit my capacity to be kind to others, you know? And I've had to be honest with my parents about this. Like, they've straight up asked, like, hey, why aren't you going to church? Or why aren't you participating in this particular kind of Bible study and you're going after this kind of Bible study instead? You know, they put it much more kindly than I've just sort of summarized here, but I've had to say what I mean to them, and it's often been difficult, but I think it's really enriched my relationship with them. They've started to see me as more of an individual. They've started to see me as more of a fully formed person and not just an extension of them. At least I get that sense. So this song has really reinforced for me that that's the right path for a meaningful relationship. Say those little things, say the big things, and suddenly you'll have this connection that you can really trust exists, you know? Sometimes it might not be the easiest relationship, but it's one that you can have faith in being fully formed, right? It's more about seeing one another. It's more about understanding that, okay, my dad doesn't just see me as his son. My mom doesn't just see me as her son. I'm a person to them, you know? I've never felt, that's a little dramatic. It's like, I've never felt like put down by my parents. I love them dearly, and they did a wonderful job, you know, raising me, you know, not to toot my own horn kind of thing, but they've never made me feel smaller. But when I see and participate in life with them in a complete way, it makes me feel larger than life. So I think that this song has really set me on that path for the rest of their days, the rest of my days. It's reassurance that saying everything, as long as it remains respectful and well-intentioned, I think is a key part of just living life together as much as you can.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And I'll say too, I'm fortunate enough that I also have not had the experience of losing a close one in my family and friends. I lost my grandmother on my dad's side, but I didn't feel like as close to her as I, you know, do with my like parents and maybe my grandparents on my mom's side. I never got to meet my grandfather on my dad's side because he had passed away well before I was born. But I think this song also, because of the topics it talks about, really like emphasizes it. Like it's something that I guess I think about, and I know, you know, it's inevitable. You know, our parents will grow and pass, and then we'll grow up and pass, and we'll leave behind our memories with, you know, the people that were close to us. And I think there's a lyric in one of the first choruses where I think the singer says, like, you know, on the last day of my life, I'll first think of you, although I'll regret saying too little, way too little. So, like, again, you know, again, the song about missed opportunities to say what they were feeling when they had a chance. But even though this important person has passed, I think the impact that it's left on the singer is still clearly very apparent and significant. And this whole song is just kind of like a love letter to that, to this person. You know, even though you're gone, you know, I still think of you. You're still part of me. Going back to your first point, it's making me kind of reevaluate the way I'm living my life. And maybe I should speak up more intentionally, you know, because of the way I remember you. And it brings me to a very Japanese topic or Japanese way of thinking that I'm a big fan of, which might be another reason why I really love this song, called Wabi Sabi. I feel like I have maybe talked to you a little bit about it, but do you know what Wabi Sabi is?
I've heard the term, but talk to me like I know nothing.
So Wabi Sabi at its core principle is an aesthetic. So what that means, it's a set of rules to basically determine what is or isn't beautiful. And Wabi Sabi is an aesthetic that was developed from a specific school of Buddhism. The main tenets of what Wabi Sabi consider beautiful are primarily around three different, I guess you could call them tenets, that nothing is perfect, nothing can ever be completed, and nothing lasts forever. So it's a very spiritual aesthetic, I guess you could say, and it's not too surprising since it comes from like Buddhism. But basically, it's a way of looking at things or classifying things as beautiful or important because of their inherent fragility. And you see this in a lot of Japanese culture, which is why I'm not surprised. You know, there's a lot of songs that probably talk about it. And I was fascinated with the concept of wabi-sabi pretty early on. Like, I learned about it in college, and when I studied abroad in Japan for my semester end project for Japanese class, we all had to do presentations on an aspect of Japanese culture, and I decided to do mine on wabi-sabi. And so I did a huge deep dive into it and like learned a lot about it. It's basically valuing and cherishing things that are imperfect and ephemeral and things of that nature, right? In Japanese culture, people love the cherry blossoms season, and they make a big deal about cherry blossoms because, one, that yes, they are very beautiful, like as flowers go. But another thing that you might not know if you're not tapped into Japanese culture is that one reason why people love cherry blossoms is because they're only around for a very short amount of time. When cherries blossom, you have this beautiful pink tree, and then within days, like all the petals just fall off. And because of how short-lived they are, you know, wabi-sabi would consider it very beautiful. There's another art style called kintsugi, which I believe translates to something gold. I think it's like added gold or something similar like that. But basically, it's the art of taking broken pottery and repairing them with gold, so that when you kind of piece together the broken clay pot, all the places where there were cracks are now like lined with gold. And the gold is there to highlight the cracks and where it broke, because that is what makes that bowl unique. So, you know, another thing from like the Buddhists, from this sect of Buddhism, and why it cherishes things like wabi-sabi, is that life is so imperfect and unpredictable that you have to, or you should, kind of value the here and now and the present, because it's unique and will never come again. There's another wabi-sabi kind of saying where you never step in the same river twice, because of the nature of a rushing river. The same river, quote unquote, same in a day, in an hour, in a second, is not the same river as it was now. And for some reason, I think I really like connect to these concepts. And so like, it's a really important part of like my life to just be present and value things that are imperfect, things that are ephemeral, things that are incomplete, because it, one, I think emphasizes the tenacity of humans and also the fluidity of nature. And I could go on for hours talking about wabi-sabi, because like I said, it's a presentation on it. Is this something that you were ever aware of?
So there's, of course, versions of some of those ideas present in other idioms and things like that. But what really struck me about what you described about wabi-sabi is the nothing is complete. I think that's not necessarily like a way I've thought about the world and relationships specifically before. And I think that even further colors the messages I'm walking away with this way away from this song, where, you know, I also, as much as I want to intentionalize and make fully formed as much as possible my relationships with the people who are here now, and, you know, their time may be limited, more so than others, I also appreciate what you said here, because it also takes the pressure off a little bit to say, hey, you're like, I'm gonna walk away with a lot from a lot of these relationships, all of these relationships, with some sort of regret. Nothing is complete, right? There's, as much as I,
nothing's perfect.
Exactly. As much as I put effort into these relationships, these connections, there's always going to be something that's left unsaid. There's always going to be something where it's like, eh, I could have handled that situation better. So even as I move forward with more purpose and move forward with the willingness to say what's on my mind and be as present and as much Dayton as possible to these people, I'll find something at the end of the day where it's like, yeah, that wasn't quite it, but that's okay. I think there's a beauty about like the retrospective element of this too, right? Not just the present. There's a beauty to the fact that like, oh yeah, this was my story with this person, and despite its flaws, there was a lot there, and I'm grateful for that. So that's what I'm sort of taking away from what you said there. It's tempering in a way I didn't expect my lesson from this song.
Even if there are, you know, some things that could have been better, it was still uniquely your experience and something that you uniquely possess with this other person. And I think that uniqueness is something that honestly, you know, should be cherished because of how, one, how unique it is, and two, how impactful it is to you, you know, with the relationships we have with the people around us. They are uniquely our own. And I think there's something to be said about that. And it's like your story, right? No one else is going to have anything exactly the same. And there's inherent value to that. It reminded me of this video I saw. So we're both Magic the Gathering fans. And there's a YouTube channel called Ristic Studies that I watch occasionally where he does deep videos on like interesting topics that are not necessarily about the game itself, but like through the lens of Magic the Gathering. And there was one video that I still remember very vividly about talking about the value of cards. So in this day and age with Pokemon scalpers and things like that, you have people that scramble to get really valuable cards, right? And usually the most valuable cards are the ones that are in pristine condition, holographic, you know, 1 of 100, and they get them encased in like hard plastic and rated by an official rater. And then if you can get the high 10 score, that's like the perfect score, it can be worth like tens of thousands of dollars because, you know, it's perfect, it's pristine. But to me, that just seems very cold and I guess empty compared to a card that is all beat up and has Sharpie marker on it because one of your friends wrote a note on it to you when it gave it to you, and you used it, you know, as one of as what the kids do when they put a card on their bike wheel to make it like flap as you bike. And from doing that, it's all worn down. To me, when I see that, like, I feel like that card could be argued to have more value because of all the stories that it holds within it. And you can just tell, even if you don't know the specific stories, you can tell that that card has stories just from looking at the frayed edges, the bent corners, you know, the marker on the face of the card compared to something that's like super shiny, pristine, no flaws in it. And I think that when I saw that video, it reminded me of the concept of, you know, wabi-sabi, and kind of made me think about like, where do I place value, right? Do I place value on perfection, on value that I think is there from what other people, you know, tell me has value? Or do I think these stories that this beat up card contains gives it more value? I think there's something to be said about that, you know?
Yeah.
When you see people selling pristine cards for like tens of thousands of dollars that are untouched,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, like the unboxed action figures, you know, in the 80s and 90s, people would like hoard them because they're collectibles and stuff. But it just feels a little sad because, you know, those action figures were made to be played with children, and their entire life cycle was in the box from manufacturing to, you know, being put on a shelf of a collector's for eternity.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up trading card games as an example, because it's a lot of what you're talking about is sort of a reason I've been taking an extended leave from Magic the Gathering. I was such a huge fan of that game throughout my college years and then into my early working career. And I slowly started to realize that I had become too calculated in not just the way I was like buying cards or opening packs. You know, I was looking for the big powerful card, the game warping kind of cards, you know, or ones that I knew were going to be popular in other people's decks, even though I had no intention of building that deck. Like, I had gotten too far ingrained into that mindset, and I found myself like resenting the game because of it, and I was like missing my old passion to just like build a deck because I liked a card. And I think if I can go on a little mini rant, I think the game is kind of rewarding that kind of behavior right now with the way that it's overprinting cards or making cards that are based on popular characters that are also really powerful. Like, it's just too much. It's rewarding the people who want to buy a big box of packs and then just dig for that one card, and then, oh, they've got the one card. Well, what happens to all of the other? There's a term for it in the community, draft chaff, you know, because when you're drafting a deck out of the packs that you build, the packs that you open, what happens to the extra stuff? What happens to the chaff? It made me really frustrated, and my first step in sort of coming to terms with this was I had an enormous box of what other players, including myself for a time, would consider quote-unquote draft chaff. I knew there were a couple cards in there that were starting to go up in value, so I was like, oh, maybe I'll just start digging through them. And then I got maybe 50 cards in, and I was like, nope, you know what? There might be something of value in here, but it doesn't matter to me. I know that Kate, she has a coworker whose sons are just getting into Magic. I'm just going to pass this off to them, And if they find something great, that's awesome. I want their inspiration to start here. If I lose a little bit of money here, if I lose a little bit of deck building potential here, that's okay. That was such a huge turning point for me. And since then, I really haven't played Magic too much. And I've moved on to Pokemon, which sounds backwards for anybody who's like in the trading card community, because it seems like Pokemon is worse than ever for some of these things. But for me, I grew up playing the Pokemon games, watching the Pokemon anime, and collecting the merchandise. I didn't really get too much into the card game, but now I have all of these characters that I have connections to. Like, specifically, my favorite Pokemon in the world are Natu and Zatu. These, like, green little, like, Aztec-inspired, like, native North American-inspired birds. And really, for no other reason than I loved the original games that they appeared in, Gold and Silver, and I love their designs, and I think they're kind of cool and spooky and cute all at the same time. And so I've really leaned into that, and anytime I open a Natu or Zatu card, I'm super happy. Even the digital form of the game right now, Natu and Zatu are like the latest set, and it makes me so happy whenever I open a card of them, even though I have like a dozen Natu cards right now and a couple more than enough of the Zatu ones. So it's like I've been able to sort of backdoor meaning into the Pokemon trading card game because I'm like bringing my stories to it. I'm bringing more Dayton to it, as opposed to with Magic, it was starting to infringe on my natural tendencies to just find joy in things. And like I think about now, it would be so much fun to collect all the Zatu cards, even though they're not valuable or something, you know.
But they're valuable to
exactly,
you.
Exactly, yeah.
And honestly, that's all that matters in the end.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought up that example, because it is something that is near and dear to me. I like collecting, and I love trading card games, but there's this... It's hard to avoid the noise of, like, the economics behind it. But there's a way to do it, and sometimes it means shifting gears, sometimes it means shifting games, but there's... Like, bring your meaning to it, bring your genuine... authentic self to it, and I think that's the best way to enjoy these games, and the best way to enjoy life a lot of times too, right?
Yeah, I think this song, as well as probably you could argue almost every song we've talked about to this point, has like that theme and undertones of like authenticity that is brought up, and it might be an innate reason why these songs were picked by us to talk about. Just I think it's something worth talking about, worth, you know, just sharing to the public and our audience, to have them maybe just stop and think about, like, what are you, like, kind of living for? Like, are you living for yourself, or are you living for some rules that you've been taught, you know, that you need to be because you need to follow A, B, and C? Sometimes, you know, it makes sense to follow the rules because they make sense, but sometimes the rules don't necessarily make sense, and they might have just been established more or less arbitrarily because there wasn't really better options, or it was just the first option and it seemed good at the time, and then it's just set up, you know, what now people would call tradition, which is actually a good segue to something I wanted to talk about before we end this episode. So I knew I wanted to pick a song in Japanese for our first volume of Marathon Mixtapes. The question was, like, when do I pull that out and what song? Mainly because I wanted to ask you or talk to you about languages in general. Not necessarily Japanese, but just kind of different languages, as... You know, the audience knows by now we both grew up in rural Wisconsin, but had very different life paths. I was fortunate enough to grow up in a non-English dominant household in America. So I grew up speaking both English and Cantonese. You were, you know, grew up white in rural Wisconsin, so mostly English. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that and ask, like, as you've grown up, have you ever considered learning another language? And I know that as an American, it can be hard to do because of the nature of, honestly, the American economy being such a superpower it is for the last, you know, century or so. A lot of countries outside of America, like, our pop culture is so strong that it just makes other countries learn English faster than, you know, we as Americans learn other languages as a whole. And so, you know, there's the joke that, what do you call a person who can speak two languages, bilingual? What do you call a person who speaks one language, American? I mean, there's a certain, like, an element of truth to that because of the way our society is developed in the global context. But I wanted to ask, has there ever been a time where you were curious about learning a language, and have you tried to learn another language?
Yes, absolutely. So, number one, I think you severely undersold how monolingual my experience was growing up. Like, I don't think my parents know. No, my parents are both monolingual as well. And there wasn't really a strong drive to learn another language beyond English. You know, there's always the sense of, like, oh yeah, you could learn like Spanish or Mandarin because it's, like, useful in the business world, but never really, like, a genuine push to be like, oh, explore this because it's interesting, or explore this because this represents another part of the human experience, right? So, as I've gotten older, I've looked back and thought about some moments where, oh man, maybe there was an opportunity for me to learn more or take a path where I learned another language. Number one, my grandfather's, as limited as my connection was to them before they passed, both of them spoke, like, casual German, and they taught me, like, a few words. Like, thinking back on it now, I think one of my strongest connections to them was the fact that I don't think they did this with any of their other grandkids, but anytime I said goodbye to them, I would say Auf Wiedersehen, and I think there's something very sweet about that, and I hope they appreciated that. It was such a small thing, and I'm sure I could have put more effort in to learn some of the German words that they still used in their casual parlance, but I think that connection was really important. That could have been a path for me, certainly. And then beyond that, the most seriously I've considered learning a language in my adult life, quote-unquote, is when I was in college, I initially came into UW-Milwaukee with no roommate. My roommate just didn't show up the first day, and I had a double room to myself for a semester. Woo, sounds great, right? It was a little lonely, but thankfully, after winter break, I came back, and there was another student in my room, and his name was Yegun. Shout out, Yegun, if you're listening. I sure hope you are. And he was a South Korean exchange student, and he taught me a little bit of Korean, which I knew a little bit through some years in Taekwondo as well, and unfortunately it escapes me now. But of course, I really appreciated my friendship with him. I wish now I would have kept in better touch with him, and there's still plenty of opportunity to do that, and hopefully he listens to this episode and reaches out. But there was a while where I actually had, I don't think he even knows this, I had a sort of Korean for Dummies type book in my Amazon shopping cart. I never pulled the trigger on it, but I was really close to Yegun in those years, and I really wanted to visit him someday. I still have that drive, and if he's ever willing to host me, I think that would be a lot of fun. And I think learning a little bit of Korean to enrich my experience there would be something really special. So there's, even though I kind of self-deprecatingly talk about how English-centric a lot of my life has been, there's been these little touch points where I haven't necessarily taken the full opportunity to dive into those languages, but they're there, and I see there's a rich world beyond even these limited connections, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I just bring it up because right before this, talking about, like, value in certain things, and if something's valuable because people say it's valuable, or it's valuable because you find your own inherent value in things. Like, do you like something because you like it or because someone has told you that these are like the traditional, you know, tenets of what gives something value? I, as someone who has grown up learning multiple languages, at least for me, one really cool thing that I've taken away, you know, aside from the ability to communicate with others in their own like mother tongue, is the ability to think with different perspectives. It goes back to how I had mentioned how sometimes things like traditions can feel arbitrary, like set up arbitrarily, because in a lot of times when you think about it, they kind of are arbitrary, not for any, you know, malevolent reason sometimes, but things just happen. And then being able to experience different cultures, being able to travel to China, travel to Japan, travel to Europe, and just kind of seeing how people live their lives there, you see that, like, oh, these people are not doing things that are very common in the US, but their society is still, you know, thriving, but they don't have very key aspects of like American society. And that kind of pops up in language too. And it's something that I, on one hand, like appreciate, and two, find it a little frustrating, because it's can be very hard to convey meaning when you have to go through different languages. Even before this episode, you had asked for some translations to help you kind of follow along the song. And I think I gave you like 3 different translations.
Oh, yeah.
And then I even like stepped in and was like, oh, actually for this like verse, this is how I would translate it.
Yeah.
That's like different than the others. Because, you know, as I've continued to try to immerse myself with media in different languages and trying to learn and keep up with Cantonese, Chinese, Japanese, it's, again, a lot of times the way you say things is very different from one language to another. And the differences are arbitrary because everyone, when they were inventing these languages, were just trying to figure out how to communicate with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And people in different places just ended up doing different things, which, again, makes me appreciate now how difficult translations can be from one language to another, and how hard it is to carry the same tone and meaning from one language to another. And something I love doing is watching foreign movies or watching American movies in other countries and just reading the subtitles or trying to read the subtitles and comparing that to what is actually said. And a lot of times it's not wrong, but I'm like, huh, so you went that way, or like, that's interesting, because it's so hard to go one-to-one. And this reminds me of a Reddit post a friend sent me about someone posting in like some r/language where they asked, why don't we have a good translation app already, right? Because technology has increased. These languages have been around for a long time, like even like Spanish to Chinese, Japanese to Italian, things like that. It's like, what are we waiting for? And then someone wrote a decently complicated sentence in Japanese and then below it in English, and then matched up the words using lines. But there was like one, like the last couple letters or characters in the Japanese sentence didn't have a match in the English sentence because all the other English words had already been paired up with other words in the Japanese sentence.
Yep.
And the guy was like, we're waiting for the sentence to end.
I like that.
And yeah, there's so much culture baked into language as well, that in addition to, you know, gaining an additional like perspective on the way I think in solving problems, even when I'm learning languages, like you really understand a different culture when you learn a language. And I see this in people that want to learn a language but don't understand that, and very quickly end up like hitting a wall in improving their fluency. And I see this more in Japanese, just because I would say Japanese is my most fluent language that I can speak that I was not like raised in an environment in.
Sure.
So like, I'm Chinese, not Japanese. And so my Japanese experience learning it was in college, and then learning it for 2 years in a classroom setting, and then going to Japan for a year and living there for a year. And so because I was learning it through a book, I was more, I guess, aware of like intricacies and grammar and tones and things like that, because it was through a textbook. Something that I didn't realize until recently, like within the last decade, is that, you know, Mandarin is a very difficult language for English English native speakers, because the languages are so different. So like the grammar is different, the writing system is different, word conjugation, things like that, they're very different. So it makes it, you know, more difficult to learn Mandarin for an English speaker than say like Spanish. And one big difficulty people have in learning Mandarin is that it's a tonal language. And so they have four tones mainly. And if you say the same syllable, same sound in a different tone, it could mean a different word, like a completely different word. And I knew that because I also learned Mandarin in like a classroom setting. So that was like taught to me. But apparently Cantonese has more tones than Mandarin. I think that has six. But I never knew that growing up. Because I learned it just by being around my parents who spoke it with each other, and then to me as I got older. And so I kind of developed this like sense, and I would know kind of like when I would speak Cantonese, if I said it a character with a different tone, like I could notice that immediately, like, oh, that sounds a little off, and then find the right tone to say what I wanted to say. But then, you know, people ask me, like, how many tones does Cantonese have? And I'm like, I don't know. I just kind of feel through it.
Yeah.
Which is a very different way than something like Mandarin or Japanese, where I had a much more formal education through it. And it happened when I was much older, you know, when I was, I guess, an adult or a teenager. So that was a very unique experience I've been able to have, learning a language through different, I guess, through different ways, basically, right? Like one, just being immersed in it with no like formal pedagogy, and sitting in a classroom and like learning it from a textbook. But because of that, like I see a lot of ways that people try to convey their ideas. And there are, again, I'm very fortunate that I have a basic, at least a basic understanding of probably like 3 to 4 languages now. And each language has their own like little unique intricacies, and there are good things about some that are better than the other languages, and there are some things that are kind of annoying because they don't have easy ways to do things that other languages have. For example, one thing that fascinated me a lot when I was like really into learning Japanese when I was in college was the English sentence, like, I miss you, to miss someone. That is a very simple sentence in English. You miss me, or I miss you. But the word miss as a verb, there is no real direct translation to Japanese.
Okay.
And I would always get a kick out of like asking my Japanese friends that could speak English fairly well, like, how do you translate like I miss you? And it would kind of like short circuit their minds a little bit, and they'd have to like stop and think about it, because there is no real like one-to-one translation for the word miss. And I think the closest you can get is something like kimi ga inakute sabishi, which translates to I'm lonely when you're not here.
Oh,
which, you know, has the same, you know, like connotation, like that's what it means, you know, miss someone. Maybe it doesn't quite have the additional meaning of like I long for you and I wish you would be here, but it's, you know, it's got the same vibes. But like you can tell, like it's a much longer sentence.
Right.
Whereas, you know, in English we have the word miss, and you know, on the flip side, there are a lot of examples in the other direction too. And I find that really fascinating as well, because you have people basically operating with different rules in their communication, and that really shapes the way they go through life.
Oh yeah, it's so fundamental.
And like how much language is baked into a country's culture and vice versa. And to go back to what I was saying, sometimes I see people struggle to get beyond a certain level of proficiency in a language, and I think it's it's because they don't quite understand that. Translation a lot of times is more difficult than they think because it is not one-to-one. And you also not only need to learn the words and the grammar, you need to learn the culture of that language to get context to make things easier to progress. Because there are ways to... Because very early on, you'll get to a point, I think, where it'll become very difficult because... And this is something that I've had issues with when I was learning Japanese, that you think of a sentence in English and then you translate those words in English into like Japanese and then kind of reassemble the sentence doing that. But one, that takes way more brain power than it needs to. And two, you end up with a sentence that isn't really natural and is not something that like a native would say. A native would go a much more like roundabout way or a much more succinct way because of the way, you know, they grew up. And I, again, find this really fascinating and wanted to bring that up and like ask you and talk to you about your experience with different languages, because I find it a much more complicated matter than some people give it credit.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think while my experience has been limited, I'm finding more and more opportunities to at least brush up against it. I just recently finished a group of short stories called You Glow in the Dark by Liliana Colanzi. She's a Bolivian author, and the stories were originally written in Spanish, and I read an English translation by someone named Chris Andrews, and I adored the poetry of the language, and I was really impressed with the translation, but there was always this little thing in the back of my mind where I was like, was the poetry present in this sentence, or was it over here? Like, where did this, the beauty that I'm finding, where did that come from? Is this a really close understanding of the author's intent? I'm not sure, and it's something I'm going to look more and more deeply into, but I think the lesson of it really is there's opportunity to look for languages different languages are reaching out to you, and to not really be too afraid of them. I think, you know, our media is so internationalized now, and it's getting more and more so with the extension of like Korean media, for example, into more Western audiences. But it, like, take those chances, even if it's some language and some culture you're not entirely familiar with. Like, that first step is just that. It's the first step in a larger interaction with a culture, a history, a language. So I can't speak much to what my experiences are with these languages yet, but I know that they've started, and that's really exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited for you, and I hope you get more chances. I could talk about language and linguistics for days. I think it's like a really big fascination of mine, but we've already been talking for a little bit, so I think time we hit the old dusty trail. Before we go, I just thought of this another very quick example of just like the different perspectives and cultures in languages. It's something I can quickly share with like our audience and you as well, that the way we think of time is very different from like an English-speaking country to an Asian, I guess more specifically like Chinese way of living. So we think of time, I guess, like front to back. You would say last week and, you know, next week, right? And you think of that kind of like on a horizontal like timeline. You're thinking of like things that came before, things that came after. In Chinese, instead of saying last week or next week, you say up week or bottom week or down week. Because in, I guess, Chinese, like, time is thought of as going from top to bottom, kind of like a waterfall.
Oh, interesting.
Which really like paints a picture of like viewing entropy, right? You're just falling, and then
yeah,
that's the natural state of how things go. And so, yeah, to say last week, you say the week above, and next week is the week below, which I think is really cool because it's very different from like an English speaking. And again, then that leads into more and more different like cultural nuances that kind of split off from, you know, Western society or like English primarily, which I think is a little neat thing.
Yeah. Again, it reframes again, sort of like the way that these people are functioning. Like, it's the way that they think about the day to day life. It's not in the same way, like, thinking about language differently reframes how you see certain things thinking about time differently, has you seeing things differently too. It's one of those base things that we think is so universal, but there's a lot to be learned by sharing and exploring those different perspectives. Absolutely. That's super fascinating. I didn't know that. On that note, I guess we'll see each other bottom week.
We'll see you in the week below.
That's better. I like that better.
Yep. We'll see you in the week below. And as always, you can always reach out to us at marathonmixtapespodcast@gmail.com. And hopefully we'll be wrapping up our volume one quite soon. So this is episode 7, episode 8 coming next. 3 more episodes left. And we'll, until then, I guess we'll see you in the lower weeks. Until then, thanks, Dayton.
Thanks, Jordan. Always a pleasure.